It's called
steak
bacon, I think.
Want to taste it?
Here.
I'm sharing the love.
Is it like
Kirby,
tofu
taste in the shape of a bacon? Oh no, eat it all. Eat it all. Enjoy.
Take it. Take
Savor
it. What is it? Is this bacon or what?
Oh,
it's
yeah.
Bacon.
Bacon? I know it's not real. I just want to know what it's made out of.
Delicious, huh?
It would taste like bacon.
Can I ask you a question? Please don't be insulting. What is
I'm guessing soy.
You're
pepper.
Guessing?
I don't know. I'm vegetarian. I don't really get it.
I said they call it bacon.
What did you do? Did you throw it on the floor?
Did you throw it?
Oh, you gave it back to me.
It's not bad.
I have to try this.
It's bad.
I think it looks kind of like pepper. Yeah.
It's soy dipped in artificial flavor.
It's like a...
There you go.
Like, that's supposed to be bad for you.
Yeah.
Thank you. So, who have you guys, like, already known each other and, like, have already conversed previously? I mean, I'm new to this kind of group, so...
None.
You guys, none?
None. Except for Griddle Cafe.
Well, there you go.
Yeah. And, like, I randomly was at... Forest Home
uh-huh.
with our, like, I had to take some of our high school students up there to fill in, so I was there, and Andrew was helping with another church that was there, so
that's cool.
He was a leader there, so were we on the same,
I think we're on the same
team and everything, like, but like,
did you meet him there?
Yeah, we met there, but it was, but like, but you know, most, even though you're a team, like, you're mostly with your own students and stuff, so it was like, hey, type, we're hanging out, cool, but like, didn't really talk at all, and then the connection came back through with the cohort, and then it was like, wait a minute.
Then we met for Gavin.
And we're like, oh my gosh, I know you! You know, yeah, so.
That's funny.
Yeah. So, it's all, we're all fresh.
Right on.
How'd you get hooked up? Did you see the website and just showed up, or do you
know? No. I met Aaron in Kentucky. I went all the way to Kentucky to meet him. Because I couldn't meet him here, you know.
You were at the Worship Arts thing?
Yeah.
So was I.
Oh, okay. So, I could have met you there, but I didn't.
I saw him there, but we didn't.
Did you know him then?
No. Oh. I saw him.
But we.
Were you in that one workshop with that one dude, Mark Pasquarelli or whatever, on preaching? Is that where?
I didn't go to any of the workshops.
Just your own. You went to your own.
I went to my own workshop, and then...
I was working on...
Because we would stay up to like...
Oh, yeah.
Four in the morning. Like,
I was working
night.
On papers, so I felt like a loser.
Oh, yeah,
like,
that's right.
I was sat in that cafe, and I was... No,
I
sat in that coffee shop the whole time and worked on papers.
I didn't go to too many workshops. I went to a couple, but...
Those things are often, like, about networking for me, like, especially because now, I mean, a lot of the things, the workshops have been done, at least, if you've been there once, you kind of have heard, you know.
Like, it's kind of scary to get around some of you guys, just because, like, just knowing church planners and people who want to plan, like, when I left church planning, I was like, I'm never doing that again. Like, I was just like, it was rewarding, I loved it. Never doing that again. You know what I mean?
Yeah. What was it for you that you didn't?
Well, this is probably a good segue into one of these discussions. You'll have to help me be really careful about not mentioning names because, like, the person I planted this church with, we were involved with the Acts 29 network. We had the whole organic church planning type, you know, we're going to do theology on tap, and we're going to do life on the brick and work with homeless, and we're going to do an open mic night at a local club, you know, and all this type of stuff, and like, you know, very, very emergent, you know, whatever that means, with quotes, emergent, you know, very, very, you know, all that type of stuff. And there was this very much... there was very much discussion about, a lot of discussion about, you know, dialoguing leadership and, you know, doing things in community and blah, 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 conversation. But as is the case many times within a church plant environment, many times you have more the entrepreneurial type personality that ends up driving some of the stuff. And it's kind of the activist kind of spirituality where the closest you, you know, you feel closest to God when you're living out on the edge and, you know, your hair is blown 100 miles back and your balls are flapping in the breeze and you're taking a risk, you know. And it's like, and is it, so constantly starting up new things and not, you know, and not recognizing that suddenly we've moved into a space where we don't have to do set up and tear down every week. We can leave our stuff up. We're renting long term. We've got more young families coming in. We're having children's ministry is becoming the primary concern of how do we fix our ministry efforts, because everything else organically is working great, you know, but we've got children's ministry. We're kind of going from all mission to half mission, half church now.
Right.
We've moved from being a mission into an established church. And there was a failure to recognize that we were an established church now. We were no longer a plant. We needed to start stabilizing some things and caring for some people in that respect. And while at the same time keeping these other organic things going. And then all of a sudden, the field of leadership changed, because all of a sudden, instead of everyone organically moving one way, one of the key pace setters suddenly wouldn't see and hear from the people around them that we need to address some long-term issues now if we want viability. And so there was, it's hard to break down trust, and, you know, and then every time you come and have a conversation about it, there'd be but we talked about this. We had the conversation.
Oh, yeah.
We dialogued about this, you know, and it's like, you know, and when you try to impress upon people that you weren't actually having a conversation, there was almost like a genetic inability to recognize that, like, you know what I mean, you know? Yeah, you know, and it's like, so, then we started to move. It forced kind of like the cloak and dagger type relationship dynamic between the leadership and the rest of the people in the church. And then all of a sudden the information started to be played very close to the vest, and only certain people were having, and all of a sudden it became very important that everybody had one-on-one conversations, because we have to follow Matthew 18. And, you know, and it's like, we're trying to decide if we're going to buy a computer. We weren't caught screwing the neighbor's dog. You know what I mean? Like, it's not a Matthew 18 issue. You know, we just need to talk about it. Capital camp, you know, investment or whatever. It was just weird. And, like, so people started to do espionage and try to find out what information was. People were playing information close to the vest. And then there started to be this groundswell to defend themselves against that kind of dragging along. All of a sudden, we really went hardcore institutional, and everybody started clamoring, we need elders, and we need, you know, and everything, clamoring for that type of stuff. And maybe we can talk about in this conversation the role of eldership and the role of, like, how do we tease out biblically, like, what are biblical models of leadership, if any, you know, or are those cultural things or whatever. So everything started to harden, and then as people started to harden here, then leadership started to harden here, and then here I am in the middle with people complaining because they've gone through 6 one-on-one conversations, not gone anywhere, and I'm saying, well, if you're pushing for elders, we'll get elders, and you can talk to the elders, and they can deal with it, because I'm not going to sell my friend out, even though I'm frustrated too, and all that stuff, you know. So elders come into play, and then that created even more hardening instead of coming together and actually conversing together and being partners in ministry together. And the leadership, who were giving the best hours of their day, that leadership started to become even more invasive, and then so I started to become more controlling and more, you know, like, driven in that respect. And then just some really bad boundaries were violated, and trust was totally blown, and it became clear, like, we don't want to go, but for the health of this church, maybe this leadership core needs to go, because we're the planters. Maybe we need to get out of the way because of the nature of who's really taking the reins. If you're entrepreneurial, you probably need to get out of the way after the first few, you know, the first 4 years, you probably need to go. And I knew that wasn't going to happen, and I was like, I can't sustain under this environment. Then I got married, and then there was, in the hardening, there was no advocacy for helping expand resources for me to be able to, you know, continue giving the best hours of my day. And so I had to start looking elsewhere, you know, not only philosophically, but there was emotional, and this is very Reader's Digest version of everything that happened. So, you know, and then went from there to Menlo Park Pres, which is classic, large, institutional Presbyterian church with a very clear pecking order of tier of leadership. And you're probably very familiar with that structure being at a Presbyterian church. And while there was some comfort in that because you didn't have to deal with certain things because you were just a cog in the wheel, after a while that started to break down as well, just because it's just like, you know, that can easily become non-responsive to people downline and things like that. So, and then like, how do you, I guess like my thing is it seems like our generation at least, or some of us young people, tend to still be succumbing to that whole modern, like, if I don't like what you're doing, then I'm just going to go do my own thing. And at some point you have to cut and run, you know, sometimes. But like, how do you enter into not just conversational leadership and modeling it and all that stuff, but like, how do you draw other leaders into that, especially when you're in a position of where they would rather discuss versus converse, where their standard phrase is, we'll get clarity on that, which is their nice backdoor way of saying, you're going to come around to the right way of thinking, which is my way of thinking. Like, how do you negotiate through, you know, helping people in that sense, not like teaching people you're a controlling jerk and you need to learn how to be conversational, you know, but like, how do we really sell the understanding? How do you control the, you know, how do you help pitch and sell people and communicate the value on, you know, there's a value in this despite maybe the potential chaos and lack of streamlining, and also too, like, I guess in light of that, how does that work within, say, if you believe you have a biblical conviction about some sort of collegial eldership type, you know, for lack of, you know, if we want to use a different term, if we think elders is too oppressive or whatever, I don't know. But, you know, like, how do you do that? Like, is the biblical understanding of eldership really a conversational group of people, of men and women who get together and talk through where we are as a community, and they kind of do that, you know, in micro, and then are,
good thing,
you know, things are trying to do it for the macro too, for their people. I guess that, I don't know if those are very clear.
Did you guys read the post, the conversational leader post?
Mm-hmm.
No.
It's really good.
The one versus converse versus discuss.
Yeah.
I don't know that you can do anything. I mean, when you're dealing with people that are so set, especially maybe the institutionalized older generation, I don't know. I mean, maybe that's just a bad attitude, but I just think they're set in that way, and you're not going to say, look, you need to hear me, unless you just go up to them and say, I don't feel like you're hearing me, and they're willing to be open to that.
Well, the scary thing is this guy's younger than me.
I think it has to be, modeled, you know. I think, I think conversation has to be modeled, and I think you have to sell people on conversation as a leadership model and as a trait of leaders. At the church, I pastor a church. At the church I'm working with, I'm pastor of leadership and ministry development, so it's my job to organize teams and mobilize people to ministry and stuff. And the approach, they haven't told me how to do anything, they're very open, but the approach I've taken is a conversational approach. So we don't really have anything that doesn't self-organize. And that's been really, really awesome for our church. And where they come from, a maybe more of a mechanistic model where it's top-down and, you know, there's the leader who's just conversating, but it's really like discussion to get them to see, like, that person's point. Yeah. All of our stuff has been conversational. Like, one of our big things, well, for any church, is how do you serve the community. We talk about, like, just, we just talk about it, and we conversate, and out of that we move towards action and stuff. And it's cool because I think one of the benefits of doing it that way too is that you, where in traditionally when we build teams, people get burnt out by teams. And a lot of times when people hear the word team, they go, forget it, you know, there's no way. That means I'm going to have to be there like every meeting.
4 more hours of my week.
Yeah, conversation though is like, come out and let's have a conversation about this and just see what comes of it, what happens from within us and, you know, what kind of bubbles over. And you get like, we get so many more people who are like, oh yeah, I'm just part of this conversation. But really, if you strip it away, it's really a team, or the beginning of a team, but not under the team label. And it opens up for people to serve and people to put in their ideas, and there's an exchange of leadership, and leadership flows from one person to the next. And there's all these like really cool things that happen, I believe, out of conversation. You know? So I think it has to be modeled. Someone has to be willing to understand the necessity for conversation and be willing to model them to say, not force them to say, hey, you know, you really have to go over to this model conversation. It's the new in thing, you know? Not like that, but you know, be willing to model and say, you know, let's just talk about this, let's conversate, let's just see what comes out of it. And it's different, though, too, than brainstorming, because I've seen some people who go, oh, let's do a conversation, and then they're just, like, pen in hand, and they're, like, ready to tear paper, you know? Like you said earlier, and it's like, here you go. Yeah, we conversated. And that's not necessarily, like, the outcome of conversation, you know? Conversation is all relational, so if the outcome is not relationships and honesty and trust, that, then I beg to differ that you even had genuine conversation.
Do you think that has to begin with the leaders giving up some leadership? I think that for that to happen, some of the leaders have to acknowledge that, have that faith that they trust their people they're having a conversation with. Because I think too often why we're in this is because leaders don't have faith that we're all adults here. And if someone makes a mistake, we can call them on that. But you don't have to have this structured organization to prevent mistakes ever from happening and prevent any blemishes whatsoever. And so they have this control. And I think until they're willing to let go of some of that and take a risk and have faith that, you know, people want to serve and deal with situations as they come up.
It's not just a control in the sense of a psychological, like I'm trying to control and be manipulative. Not
control
that
the environment.
It is like that, but control the environment, control the organization, control the
product.
Church. Control
I've
the product.
I've heard churches say, we won't do that because we can't control the product.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know?
Problem solving is, you know, we've been so instructed to problem solve. When something happens in your church or something happens in your community, what's the problem? You think of a solution and you go at it. And what you actually do in there is you're not solving the problem. You're not solving the root of the problem. You're just solving the fruit of the problem. And you're wasting and expending valuable time and energy and resources and all of that. And instead of what happens when a problem emerges in a community, a non-controlling leader will step back and allow that problem to take its due course and allow for chaos to bring new life. It's a lot different. And it's a trust in the process that chaos will bring new life. I think the theological standpoint is that after death there's always resurrection. And we don't, as leaders, oftentimes don't take a resurrectional position on a lot of the things that we do on our churches. We're not willing to let our churches die. Yeah, or let our churches, certain components of our churches die, or certain visions die. We want to control it. You know, no, this must happen. This is like what God gave me. You know, it must. And leaders go to great amounts of effort to make sure that it happens instead of taking a step back and just saying, maybe God wants to do something new here. Let's just see. Let's see what the chaos does. Let's see what happens. Let's see what self-organizes.
It sounds like conversation ends up being more the fallout of some other paradigm reality. Like it sounds like it's a practice that bursts out of a completely different set of worldview, I guess, on leadership, you know, to let use a better, you know, weird term, worldview. But like, you know, like I think what Trevor's saying too about we have this tendency to have to try to, you know, manage it, you know, and I think life support's a great word for it from Andrew. Like we, you know, something's coughing and hacking and it's like, you know, it's like a horse, you know? Like 90% of how our church's function is in this kind of like 1925 Seabiscuit racehorse kind of thing. It's like the horse's leg is broken. Just shoot it. You know what I mean? Like let it die. You know what I mean? Let it die. You know, or put it out to stud. But like, let's get something out of it. But just let it die sometimes. You know, and it's like, I just wonder if I just wonder if some of it from a theological standpoint comes to, I guess one of the phrases here, put it this way, one of the phrases that floats around a lot in our leadership discussions and some of the ministries that I'm helping with at our place is, we need to have a profound respect for the Spirit of God to be able to do what the Spirit does in people. Instead of mentally raising people into submission, you know what I mean? and it's like, you know, like right now, like at our church, like one of our pastors is on a big kick of like, we need to do life groups and they need to be, you know, locally maintained and they need to be organic and they need to be balanced in all the five purposes.
What's
you know?
The word for it needs know? To be organic.
Yeah.
We're going to make it organic.
Yeah, it needs to be organic. Yeah.
We need deer.
You know what I mean? And like, so, so the senior pastor seems to be very consensus oriented in that sense, so it looks conversational and he's like, okay, you know, so there's this 3-week series on life together, you know, and the first message out the gate is like the 25 one another commands in scripture, so it's like you gotta do this because God commands it, you know what I mean? It's this very good Baptist sort of ordinance theology. God commands it, so do it. You know what I mean? So that's kind of front-loaded. And then they asked me to preach on the second installment, and I'm just like, what am I going to do with this? You know what I mean?
I don't really believe in this.
Yeah.
So what I ended up doing is I just got up and said, you know, I really don't care what it ends up looking like, which probably ended up making the senior pastor and the executive pastor mad. I really don't care what it ends up looking like. And you're like, what I really think matters is, you know, as an example, here's Colossians 3. Here's a picture of what a community, traits of a community. How that works for you, I don't know. You know what I mean? But here's this great picture. And then, like, letting the Spirit of God work on people. You know what I mean? And it's like, and I don't want to be passive in that. But, you know, having that kind of respect for the Spirit of God, saying, here's the text that invite us into language of what we could look like, and then let's do this, versus saying, here's the 25 one another commands that thou must obey, you know what I mean? And that's a very different approach, you know, it's a very different approach. And then being okay with the fact that as soon as I walk off the platform, I know that 80% of what I said won't be remembered anyway, just what we know about cognitive psychology, and the other remaining 25%, probably about, you know, 24.9% of them will say, well, I don't want to do that anyway. You know what I mean? And just be like, okay, you know, and be like okay with it, you know? Whereas, like, the dominant model is still so driven by this pragmatic sort of, you know, if you can, you know, build this huge thing and manage this huge thing, then you're a successful leader. I think some conversational leadership is dealing with our understanding of what is success. You know, what is successful leadership? It flows from an understanding of successful leadership and what a successful church even ends up looking like, you know.
I have some notes from a blog post I'm working on.
Is this mine?
Yes.
That looks really good.
Smells good.
I don't know. What do you guys think of this stuff? Do you understand how conversation is like an artistic collaboration? Where it's like, you know, artists, like musicians, like dancers do this too. They get together to improvise and come up with a new artistic work, you know. A lot of times the visual arts, fine artists, they come together to learn from each other. And so conversation is often like this collaboration effort of the new work that's going to come out from each of our voices. But even go farther than that, not just voices, but each of our truths. Each thing that, each experience, each mindset, each whatever you think is true, being offered kind of like as a color to the portrait that we're creating. Yeah. Very different from that, from your model. It's like, here's one color. This is the only color that exists. It's the Bible's color, right. And I happen to agree with it. You know,
and if you disagree with it, you disagree with God.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, totally.
But I like the word chaos, as you were using earlier. I think that's a really good way to illustrate. Just, you have to be able to submit to chaos and be able to just be okay with that, just like artists, you know, when you're creating something, you have to be okay going through the chaos.
Absolutely.
And if you're not willing to accept chaos, and if you're needing to have control over the whole situation, then you're not going to get anywhere, and you're especially not going to let the Spirit of God lead you.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Even artistically, if you create something, like the best art always comes out of a process of frustration, you know? And if you don't have that frustrating process, like, I've noticed, like, I always want to hear the story behind the piece because it gives the piece more meaning. But when I ask the story and they're like, oh, no, you know, I just... and no biggie, like, you can usually tell. You're like, oh, okay, you know. usually comes out of frustration, a frustrating process. Creative process is a process of chaos.
That reminds me of, like, when I was about 18, I got into the music business, and I was a singer-songwriter for Arista, and got the opportunity to do some stuff in the GMA, the whole Christian music thing, and I remember sitting across the table from, I hate it when people say, I sat across the table from a well-known person that you recognize, and then they don't tell you who it is, you know? I sat across the table from Michael W. Smith, and he was talking about this song that he wrote, and he goes, yeah, I sat down, I wrote it in 15 minutes. And inside I'm just like, I know you're way richer than me, and by every other standard, you're way more successful than I am, and you're probably a better songwriter, but that song sounds like you wrote it in 15 minutes, you know what I mean? Like, it's like, here, I slapped it out, I pulled it out of my butt, and
if you think about it, I think most Christian music is written from that perspective. And then also, too, I think most sermons are written from that perspective, where people don't run things through their life. And to me, when you do a sermon, it's a artistic, creative process.
Oh, totally.
For me, anyhow. And I try to wrestle with it and try to, not only with the text and what it's saying for my life, but wrestle with it in terms of my world, my mind, everything, you know, everything that it entails.
Yeah, I think that goes back to what we said earlier. I think a lot of sermons today start at the end, and they just figure out the best way to get there.
Yeah.
And force a way to get to what the end result is. Instead of
sermon.
The struggle and the creative process, they say, this is the end already, and I just need to figure out the best way to make it sound pretty to get to the end.
They have sermons looking for verses.
Yeah.
You know.
I was listening to Dan Kimball this morning, and he was just talking about how sermons are these things that wrap up nicely and, like, you know, the application points, instead of being this broad, open-ended thing where we're left with questions, we're left with difficult things that we've already struggled with, and then we wrap it up and say, okay, this is nice and neat. And then, okay, I'm at the end of my notes here, you know, that's it, I'm done, amen.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's just this idea that it's so much more, that our lives go on past, you know, what we're saying and what we're preaching about, that we want people to continue to wrestle with these issues.
That's so good.
Oh, yeah.
Outside of the walls of the church.
I found that I've become much more intentional about, instead of speaking for 20, 25 minutes, even to create a broad strokes, even the broad strokes handoff, like, here's the fishing pole type preaching. I've even gotten to a point now where in the last 6 months, I've gotten to the point where I probably teach more in this respect, more along like a classic homily sort of line. And I mean, if I preach 15 minutes, that's long now. And I don't do a lot of stories or anything like that, like, you know, cute stories to illustrate the point. I pretty much read the text, you know, because I think we need to just let the text speak for themselves. I read the text, kind of make some summarizing points or draw out some things, and then I just ask a crap load of questions, and then I pray, you know. And I'm finding that, like, that's what I'm getting better feedback. I'm being challenged even as I speak, you know. And I find out that, like, there's the response, the spaces for response after that many times is, it really empowers people to be able to really take a space in the next few moments of response in the next remaining 30, 40 minutes of whatever we plan after that. They really are actually better equipped than giving them the ideas, because the questions have really stirred up stuff, you know? I just wonder if it would be better if we tended to do that, because I think that flows out of that respect for the Spirit of God, respect for our people, and understanding that they're not stupid, you know? And they just need some nudging. You know, they just need some nudging, and then like God kind of like, God's brought this community of people together, and it's not a mistake that they're together. So instead of coming top down, being leaders like Aaron saying, stepping back and saying, who's around the table in our local faith community? Well, they have these gifts, and they have these passions, and they have these, you know, and they care about this, and they generally all want to do that. So how do I nudge them that way, and or like keep that out to let them see it and let them go for it? You know what I mean? And then my job is more to, you know, for lack of a better term, facilitate who, you know, who they already are. You know, like we are as a community. We forget that as a community in our local area community, we are the will of God in the sense of who we are. And our context isn't just determined by, oh, we live, you know, we're working in the urbanized, you know, middle class, working class, largely Hispanic area of Reseda, South San Fernando Valley. So that means, you know, it's not just that, but it's like we ourselves are the context as well. And, you know, having respect for the context many times determines the will of God. You know, like you don't pee in the refrigerator. You know, like you go into the, you know, you go, Eric's like, you don't.
Really?
You don't. I do every day. You know what I mean? Like when you're in the kitchen, the context determines the kitchen. In the kitchen, the context determines, but the will is for that room. And so you don't wash your dishes in the toilet. And you don't pee in the refrigerator. And it's like, you know, it's the same thing with people in our communities. You know, like.
Have you ever used that in a sermon?
I have, actually.
To that.
I have. Yeah. They laugh. And then I get 10
minutes. I guess we should laugh.
I know for me, and unfortunately, I don't have the experience of pastoring a church, but like in youth ministry where I'm working, I'm moving towards this idea of just guiding people instead of teaching them or students, that I don't have to necessarily dictate where they need to go, but really provide the information that's going to help them process it themselves, and then let the Spirit, let Christ do the teaching within this moment. And I'm almost wishing that, you know, my pastor is going to say to me, hey, Andrew, you want to preach? It's not going to happen, but I just want to go up there and just like present them with, you know, 5 minutes worth of material, and then just let them sit for 20 minutes in the silence of the sanctuary and allow them to be taught in that moment. And unfortunately, we're a dying congregation, so, you know, everyone, the median age of, like, 80, I'm not kidding, like, I'm not exaggerating.
Let them sit there, right?
Yeah, like, I'm sure they wouldn't be ready for that, but, like, when I'm thinking about youth ministry and thinking about what students need, like, they just need the space to process, and, like, our role as pastors is to guide them in that sense that we're facilitating enough, but like the real work is up to them. You know, if you're gonna guide someone up the mountain, you know the path and you know the way, but you're not tugging them up the mountain or you're not pushing them up the mountain. You're just showing them the direction. You're allowing their muscles to do the work, their brains to say, okay, I need to put one foot in front of the other, which is completely different, I think, than the paradigm that we're seeing now. But for me, it's that understanding that I'm not the one who's doing this. I may have an enlightened vision of more spiritual or theological knowledge, but God is the one teaching people in their own individual lives, which to me is just like, how can we miss this? Like,
totally.
That makes me think of this girl, Gina, a couple years ago, and she was part of a little house church we were doing, and at the same time, this was when I was working at a larger church, and so we'd go to there, a bunch of us would go there on the weekends, but we had this kind of church thing going. And she was from a Catholic background, and so this whole Protestant thing was kind of new to her, and the rock band, you know, all that kind of stuff. But she said something really interesting that stuck with me, that, you know, I started doing, allowing for some silence, which our church has been used to programming everything, and like, you know, you do the songs,
the wall of noise,
worship leader praise between whatever songs, and then they do a closing prayer, and then whoever comes up and does announcements, someone comes up and preaches the whole time, and there's no space for anyone to think or to pray on their own. And so we started just sticking little bits of silence here and there. Sometimes it'd be like after a song, and just, you know, so people wouldn't freak out. We'd say, you know, let's just take a few minutes of silence, just want to say something to God. And she, just being really inexperienced and not really seeming to be very deep at all, said to me one day, she's like, you know, I really like when we, after we sing a bit, and then there's some silence. And I said, well, what do you like about that? And she said, well, you know, a lot of times the words of the songs are like what I want to say to God, or like the words that you pray are things that, you know, I agree with. But she's like, sometimes there's other things I want to say to God that aren't like what everyone else is singing. And she's like, if there's some silence, I get a chance to like for me to like say what I want to say. And I think that's a good illustration of what we're talking about, is like people are at different places and they're willing and ready to respond, but we have this one-sided conversation when we gather in these large groups, and we're just like doing all the talking, and we never give people a chance to just sort of to sit with a question or to pray whatever's on their heart. We're trying to dictate it all because we want it to be, because we know what they should be praying.
Totally.
We know what they should be saying to God.
Or the 30-second of silence, like, yeah. let's now confess our sins.
Yeah, right.
And I'm going and they're like, and now Lord, and like, wait, no, like, I have to do like two, two more.
Exactly.
Or what about the fake 20-second greet?
Yeah, right.
Hello.
Totally.
I wanted to, you know, it's funny how, like, we've had 30 years now of, and I don't want this to sound incredibly ungracious, you know, but, like, we've had 30 years. There's two things I want to be, is honest and gracious. Honesty has never been a problem. Graciousness I'm really working on.
I don't think anyone's got this far on the tape yet.
We've had 30 years of this kind of pragmatic CEO, church growth movement type stuff, and...
Were you guys
it's,
from
it's
what church?
A whole bunch of
Okay, I'm so interested.
Oh, cool.
I don't know.
You want to join us?
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm like kind of looking over there. And it's like not
what's your name?
Stephanie.
Yeah. I'm Nathan.
Andrew.
Trevor. Okay.
Eric.
And
Aaron.
Where are you from?
I go to Trinity Presbyterian Church.
Oh, my wife goes there.
Really?
Yeah, she's in Santa Ana, right?
Yeah, Santa Ana.
Yeah.
I go to school at Westmont College.
Cool.
And I have some connections to the First Presbyterian Church over here.
Oh, cool.
So I like have an art exhibit up there. So I'm just interested in art from the church, I guess.
Very cool.
Oh, so I was trying to listen. Yeah. Who was talking about art?
All of us.
Okay. I was like, oh, right on.
We're, obviously, we're talking a little bit, just kind of what we call conversational leadership. And actually, you can take this, so when you want to, you can read it at some other time. Aaron wrote that on his blog, and feel free to jump in at any time.
Okay.
So, you don't have to read it now, but just for your preacher reference. What I was going to say is, like, we've had 30 years of this kind of like pragmatic type leadership that kind of like. One of my interns a few years ago told me, he said, you know, we've handed everyone this neat little wrapped up box of Christian theology and practice, and it's so wrapped up, so nice that, like, A, you can't get it back, you can't open it and see what's in it, and it's wrapped up so pretty, some of us don't want to open it, because it's like you get this beautiful package, and you just go, oh, beautiful gift, but you don't want to look inside, you know, it's like, it's beautiful.
Am I disappointed?
Yeah, you know what I mean? And it's like, and then we wonder, because, like, really the pragmatic church movement for all, because there's benefits in what we see and everything, and, like, I think one of the articles talked about, you know, why aren't we more gracious toward what the more modern established church has accomplished, that there's still formation going on there, and there's still needs being met, and so being gracious to that. But, basically, the pragmatic church movement, that type of stuff is represented in big groups, things like Saddleback, Willow Creek, that type of stuff. They are basically just the established modern church on cocaine. You know what I mean? Like, they're just with a budget, you know?
Right,
like, you know,
hyper modern.
Yeah. They're just, that's what they are, you know? And it's like, and we then, so we have this system that's about, like Andrew's saying, handing you the fish every day, you know, in the name of good things like relevancy, because, like, you know, and giving people tools and stuff like that, you know, like all this, you know, like, you know, those are honorable good desires. We want our people to be able to have tools and handles of what it is to follow Jesus. But I think it's kind of, when we don't force people to take responsibility for themselves in that respect, and we start handing them a steady diet of that, we turn our people into what Howard Thurman calls, we turn them into emotional cripples in many ways, or spiritual cripples. And so then we wonder why we then have churches full of, and I don't say this to be mean, but, like, we have churches full of spiritual adolescents who are like 60, 70, 50, 40, 30, you know, 20, and it's not a generational thing, it's just who have been handed this thing their whole life, and then we wonder why they pitch fits when you change things on them. We wonder why, you know, when we ask questions that start to shake, just say, hey, let's rethink what we mean when we talk about what does it mean to value the Bible. Then everyone freaks out, you know what I mean, and then all of a sudden you're a backdoor liberal just because you're trying to ask a question, you know, and then, you know, something like, we wonder why when we do say, hey, why don't we start emphasizing life groups because everyone is so disconnected in our church. There's not just a, well, I don't like that, or that's not my learning style, or that's not what I want, but there's this 50 extra layers of this unnecessary emotional inflammatory caca that comes out like, you're trying to destroy my church. And it's like, I'm just trying to help you, I love you. You know what I mean? And we wonder, you know what I mean? And we're shocked. We're shocked after that type of leadership, and then we're shocked at the product, for lack of a better term, the product that's there. You know, like, we're shocked at the results, and then we're frustrated, you know? And then in some ways we either, what we tend to do is either say, screw it, and we all leave, or we stay and we get better, you know what I mean? Or we just acquiesce, you know? It's interesting how it's just always interesting to me how we don't connect to the stream of how we, our history, you know, we're very ahistorical, especially Protestants, you know? And it's like, we don't really see it in the stream of things. We're so right here with, you know, oh, we have a new 40 days of something that's coming up, and we have a new, you know, whatever it is, you know. You know what I mean? And it's like, you know, and then it makes you want to throw up your hands and go to the other extreme. Like, this one guy said to me, he's like, I don't want to be part of a church that has a vision or a mission statement or a strategic 5-year plan. I just want to have a church where I share life with people, we're honest and real with each other, we grow old together, and we die together. You know, I just wonder.
Is that even possible, though?
Yeah. I don't know.
For all the talk about, you know, being anti-organizational, anti-institutional, it's a myth. I mean, even here amongst friends who are just talking, there's a degree of organization. I mean, we had to coordinate stuff to all gather and meet, you know? Like, there is an amount of organization that goes with anything, and the bigger you get, the more organization you need. And that's life. Mm-hmm. That's, I mean, trees, and that's nature, that's everything. Everything's like that. So, it kind of sends a chill down my spine when I read people like, we need to get away from organization and institution and be these kind of anarchists, in it, organizational anarchists, you know? I don't think it's. I think it's ideal, but I don't think that it's feasible.
Even the desert monks like got together on a regular basis and met with each other.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Are you joining us?
Yeah, I'm gonna join you.
All right, cool, man. The table is organically grown.
This is chaos.
We don't plan this. I know.
This isn't planned.
This is chaos. Yeah, more than married.
No, we were uplifting the value of chaos earlier.
Yeah. We will have to form a committee. Yeah, we're going to have to form a committee soon. Yeah,
totally. Well, that's the thing at our church, the Baptist church, and, you know, I always joke around when we get into meetings and say, you know, basically, Baptists are basically... Presbyterians that just aren't as organized, that's all.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like, so. What's your name?
Evan.
I'm Nathan.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, Nathan.
Andrew.
Andrew. Nathan.
Eric.
Yeah.
Trevor.
Trevor.
Yeah. So what do you think are some of the things that contribute to us not wanting to be a part of organization and contribute to a part of handling things certain ways? Being refugees instead of, what would be the other metaphor? Light in a dark place.
I'm a fan of organizations.
Are you?
I like organizations.
I don't mind it.
It's just when it's misused.
It's a modern
use, you know.
I'm still Presbyterian, for crying out loud.
I think my theology along those lines tends more toward probably an Episcopalian type theology, like, you know, like I would say, I'm a charismatic Anglo-Catholic Quaker. So, you know, I love the security of a top-down structure, as long as I understand that top-down structure is in dialogue and in conversation, and understands that their primary responsibilities are spiritual, and that it's top-down, not in the sense of ordering and bossing me around, but in the sense of there's a chain of care that they're responsible for my spiritual nurture,
yeah.
then I can be very much part of that. Like, I'm in the process of starting probably a novitiate with the Lindisfarne community, which is a new monastic thing based out in Ithaca, and the abbot and the abbess for Lindisfarne, technically, you know, are bishops in this autocephalous province of the charismatic evangelical Episcopal Church and all that stuff. You know what I mean? It's not a hierarchical, even though it's hierarchical in on paper,
yeah.
It's not a hierarchical in spirit, and it's more a we're here to come alongside you and be your soul friend and care for your soul and that sort of thing. So I really enjoy that. I like that. I need that. But I really like the Quaker notion of dialogue, and like when we talk about like committee, you know, type thing, like they have in Quaker tradition, we have, you know, they do a called discernment committee or whatever, where you get together and you enter into dialogue with people. I think some of those practices have been around for hundreds of years, but it seems like we're nervous about using
it. In your guys' contest, do you guys have spaces for conversation, whether it be within, you know, the people that you know, or within your church ministry settings? Is there like sacred space for like conversation?
Yeah. Intentional space?
Yeah. Is that like kind of hurt it?
It might be called something else. I don't know what they would say if it's our block for conversation, but I would assume that if you were to ask the pastors of the local churches around here, they would say it's in life groups, probably, and be their answer.
Or conversation, whatever they're calling them.
You know, that the discussion about what's going on and conversing would happen there.
That's interesting. I wonder how much of that conversation that happens in group life transforms the higher up,
the community,
the church life.
Yeah.
The higher up? The leadership?
Yeah, because ultimately in our churches, the higher up controls
right.
The bottom, right? So, yeah, like pastors, eldership.
Yeah.
But in life groups seem to be really on the bottom
right.
of the spectrum. But what if this change of power went more to life groups to influence the community as a whole?
That you know,
conversation.
Yeah, complete democracy.
Influence the community or influence the higher up?
Well, higher up. That's assuming higher up is a part of community.
Right. I would doubt very seriously that the percentage of life groups impacting the higher up is there.
I would think the value for a lot of people, especially in the dominant models are for life groups, is so that because so much of ministry has devolved into administrative implementation, that we talk about life groups as a way to continue to realize that we have a spiritual responsibility before God for the spiritual nurture of people, but we don't have time to do that because we have to worry about the capital campaign and the $375,000 roof remodel and the fact that, you know, so-and-so's wife is pissed off because you moved the American flag off the stage. All these deep essential things in ministry. So we know that we have a responsibility before God to do that, and so life groups then becomes, in the dominant model, a way to offload our shepherding responsibility so that we can get back to the professional work of what we do by giving the best hours of our day to this thing called ministry, which ends up being administration. I think a lot, and that might be cynical, but I think that's happening for a lot of people.
I mean, they would probably come back with, well, that is how we're shepherding, you know,
right.
Not offloading it, that's how we're doing it.
Right.
Type of thing.
Totally.
Whether it's succeeding
or like,
not.
Like, I think it's a good point because I never thought of small groups being the bulk of where conversations should happen.
Mm-hmm.
And but I think that's interesting, you know, like that the bulk of conversation would happen. If the bulk of conversation happens primarily in our churches in life groups, then leadership's challenge is to allow to take from that conversation and engage that conversation and see what kind of, you know, skim the surface, like a latte, you know? Get what's coming up, you know?
Do we have enough leadership?
Or a nice cold beer, you know?
Do we have enough leadership within the life groups that are dialoguing with the leadership?
Yeah, I'm sure they get together once every other month to have leadership training, but it still goes down.
Training of
leaders
be
right.
Of the life groups, and then also this constant dialogue between the leadership and the leadership of the life groups, so that there's this connect, not this mandate to have these, and then you push them off to the side and check in with them.
Well, even one of the functions that I'm kind of reluctant to get involved
part of me just wants to, doesn't want to follow the typical path, but they're so, you must be a part of a life group, you know, and that's anytime you want to get any type of leadership application or whatever, they're like, are you involved in a life group type of thing? And I'm resistant to being a part of one because of that. And also, they also do it where every week all the life groups study what's been given to them by about the message from the last Sunday. So every single one of them study the exact same thing about the message that was just given Sunday. And so it doesn't, it's a more of the top-down dictating what's going to be
happen in life.
Yeah, and what the conversation will be about. And I think that gives less
that's our thing to control because, like, so much heresy happens.
I mean, it's good. I mean,
what does that mean to you?
There is positive impact. I mean, that gives people a chance to talk about what happened. And, I mean, there are positives to that, but I'm just fearful of it being too structured.
Part of me likes that idea in the sense that, in a way, we're almost forcing, for lack of a better word, like the integration of your daily, weekly life with the messages on Sunday. But yeah, I also see your concern.
But like the structure, well, like the outline is given from the leadership at the church to the life group leader.
So you're saying
it's
not even just the material, it's the message is taken out of it, it's just the message itself, like the whole.
I haven't actually been to one yet, so I couldn't give a detail. But I know that the materials is passed out. It's not just talk about it. It's actually an outline.
Like a curriculum.
A curriculum, exactly.
It's more than just the scripture. It's a whole take on it.
Right.
This is what everyone's talking about.
Right.
Don't you guys think, though, that we're sort of kidding ourselves to think that life groups or Bible studies are really helping people integrate their spirituality into their lives? Because to me, I mean, that's what we always tell ourselves, right? This is so that during your week, you're also talking about spiritual stuff. But I think it does the opposite. I think it serves to solidify that way that we compartmentalize our lives.
Mm-hmm.
And I would like to see more leaders when they're just out at a coffee shop or, like, you know, because I've fought with this and I've been thinking about starting another house church.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden I realized I always have these people over for dinner on Sunday night.
Yeah.
And my first thought was like, oh, I'm going to start, we'll become a house church.
Right.
And I was like, why
is that,
like, make it something?
Yeah.
And all I started to do was to actually be a little thoughtful about it. Like, maybe, like, for instance, a girl just went on a trip around the world that had been coming to our house, and everyone's hanging out. It wasn't a church meeting, it wasn't Bible study. And I said, hey, can we pray for you because you're leaving tomorrow? And it was totally random. We weren't like a church, but we all prayed for her, and it was great.
Yeah.
And it's like, the minute you call something a life group or a small group or a Bible study, all of a sudden everyone brings all their baggage of what that is and the structure of it. Not that structure's bad.
Who's the leader?
Exactly. Who's the leader?
Who's the host?
Who's bringing the guitar, you know?
Right.
And
who's providing the dessert this week?
Well, exactly.
And you have no need to try to reach out or free another night your week to meet with a group of friends because your friends are all at life group and you're doing that once a week and you become just used to that, and that's what you do. That's your time to build relationships, build friendships, and all the other days of the week are filled, and
it compartmentalizes spirituality even more.
We got back to the disorganization that we were talking about, that helped.
But I think it
wasn't really possible. But yeah, no,
I'm not fighting against organization or structure.
What you're talking about, though, too, is a self-organization that happens,
right,
you know, which is different than a forced organization. Forced organization is a leader taking control of something. Self-organization is allowing it to naturally just kind of organize itself.
Well, two things on this whole thing, too, is like, I think life groups affecting the whole structure from the bottom up, naturally, organically, whatever the word we want to use, emergently.
Wait, we have this game. We got together on Tuesday and we had beers and we said every time we said some type of buzzword, church buzzword, we'd have to take a drink. So it's a drinking game. You better watch out.
Yeah, I think that could work if you have responsive systems of communication and responsive leadership structures. Like, one of the things that we have is, like, our eldership level is incredibly disconnected from the staff and our people, and our people are very disconnected from the staff, and the staff's very disconnected, you know, you have these individual structures set up, and then everyone's just kind of operating, and then it creates all these weird things that happen, and it's like, so I think you have to have some sort of organizational system that is a healthy system, whether it's a macro, big picture, hands-off system, or whatever it is, but you gotta you got to have healthy systems in place, and I think healthy systems are rooted in healthy people, and I think in healthy understandings of how we do things, and you know, I think they're even, as easy as this may sound, you know, they're rooted in healthy spirituality. Like, we have to remember that, like, despite all the organization we're doing, we're not a Fortune 500 CEO corporate culture. Like, we're supposed to be this society. Like, it's a society, you know. And I think too, then, on the other thing, I'm trying to blank now.
Well, you're blanking out. I need to get changed for the meeting.
Systems in place. And then we were talking about something else, and it's like
society, not a structure.
No, before that, and from all that you guys have talked about, that inspired a thought for me.
Well, I'll just use the blank. I also want to clarify that, like, I am definitely pro life group. Like, I think it's a positive thing, but I think that it just, I think sometimes that it becomes where we're, like, we use it as a crutch, and people are just taught to turn their brain off and turn their everything else off because this is a system, and then there's no other, everything fits nice and neatly, and as long as you're involved in the life group, as long as, you know, you're going to church on Sunday morning, you don't have to do anything else.
Right.
And you're showing up at the soup kitchen every other Saturday, and that's it, you know?
I have to raise the issue just because this is my current situation and probably will be for a long time. It's just like this understanding of healthy spirituality when my role as a pastor and my role in church life is going to be the people who are 60 plus. Like, and for me, it's a hard time even convincing them to start to begin to think in a different manner that, you know, I don't want to say they're wrong, but I want to provide them with an opportunity to explore these different opportunities when it's like, I've done this for the last 60 years of my life, like, why should I change? This is working for me. And so when I enter the whole emerging conversation, I always have to, as much as I don't have the luxury of being in a 20-something church, you know, and how to combine those two worlds, because I feel in my heart that it's a possibility for this change to occur within this structure that's been set up in this generation that comes from, you know, in the 1920s and 1930s, because I feel like God's Spirit's moved, but I don't know what has gone wrong where they're so closed off to that change, and then how to begin to open those doors, or is it a matter of just waiting 20 years till they all die out? But, you know.
Try finding the older people in your church who are more very, like, high activity. Find them and start dialoguing with them. Like, don't make a big thing about it, but start dialoguing with them. They'll get excited about the ideas if it makes sense. That's like one thing that you could do to kind of be a bouncing ball for you to see where your church is at. Because if they won't be interested in it, then you're really going to get in trouble. But if they are, and they're some of the kind of younger, the older generation, then you don't have to wait forever to start changing something, and you'll move to it eventually.
Mm-hmm.
Besides, if your church is multi-generational, like, you might find what you have to offer as a church and grow toward you might be a different vision than just the typical structure.
Yeah.
I wanted to, like, Aaron was saying, you know, like, conversational leadership that steps back from the chaos and lets it develop. Maybe, because, like, we have some of these same things. Like, we have 80 and 90 year olds who are just like, hey, it's great, do whatever you want. And it's not because, and some of them have an honest, big, broad picture of ministry, because they are the widows and the widowers of the people who moved to the Valley in 1945 in the big boom of the first suburb, and they built that church. You know, they worked 50-hour weeks and double mortgaged their homes and built that church themselves. You know, they come home and their husbands would be up on the rafters, you know, like, so they have this pioneering vision for ministry.
Yeah.
Plus two, they're like 80, 90 years old. They've got one foot in the grave. They don't give a crap.
Right.
They're going to die soon anyway. You know what I mean? Like, they know, hey, yeah, take the organ out. Hey, we don't care. You know what I mean? It's like, it's that next group down that gets really like, you're going to change the church, you know, and like, we moved some chairs a little bit in one of the Sunday school rooms, and suddenly there was this anger, and like, I'm suddenly being yelled at. I'm like, yeah, I'm a vindictive jerk like that. I moved those chairs to make your life difficult. That's the kind of person I am. You know, I mean, like, it's really weird, you know? But the thing is, I wonder with that generation or in those situations, and the thing is that it's influenced people. So I have 20-year-olds who have that attitude. Don't change anything in this church. I'm the young, old generation. You know what I mean? I'm the young, old timers, you know? And it's like, I wonder if in those situations, as a conversational leader, it's not so much, it's probably partly like what Evan's saying is like, pick up pick up with the people that you can pick up with, but also to just having, teaching us the compassion as leaders,
yeah.
teaching us to have the long-suffering, compassionate, kind, love-filled leadership that steps back and just gives dignity to these people and affirms their understanding of their walk with God and their spirituality and stewards them into their resting
right.
place. You know what I mean? Really honestly, and like celebrates that. Like we had a worship leader who was brought in 8 years ago who by the former pastor to force the change on worship. You know what I mean? And so the pastor took the hits on it, and then this worship leader became the lightning rod for those issues. And like whether we like it or not, and as petty as it can become, how we our corporate worship practices deeply resonate with our understanding of who God is and like all that stuff. And then all of a sudden there's this message for 8 years of, well, not just you're wrong, you're wrong and we disagree, at least there's some dialogue there. It became you're irrelevant. Like your spirituality and your practices of spirituality are irrelevant. I mean, like that was what was communicated. I mean, that's horrible leadership, you know? And so obviously because we package this, here's the fish, the responses aren't filled with maturity, even from people who should be mature, so there's this poison that comes back, and there's this poisonous, you know, dialogue going on, and then finally the worship leader of the last 2 years got sick of it because it was just getting pettier and pettier and pettier, and so he bailed, you know. We reorg, and now I'm in charge of the current worship leader, and I said, all right, I don't care even if the senior pastor is not liking it. We are going to do a ding-dong hymn every Sunday. One hymn. Just one hymn every Sunday. You're going to throw these people a bone, and we're going to sing it with vigor, and we're going to sing it if we like it, and we're going to value it. And we're even going to teach to it. So, like, when we're doing worship, part of my role is to kind of help paint the landscape sometimes, and before every hymn, there's always something that celebrates this hymn, celebrates the content of the hymn, teaches to the content of the hymn, and even the young people get into it. And it's completely, radically overhauled the climate of the church in that respect, simply because we said, we're just going to have compassion and mercy toward you and your needs, and we're going to steward you toward your grave. And in 30 years, this church is going to look exactly the way you hate, praise God. But, you know what I mean? But it's going to go there regardless. And it's more about, you know, I wonder if even conversational leadership isn't even about learning a new way to be effective as much as it's about God nurturing us in a shepherding heart toward our people. You know, a heart that's patient and a heart that's kind. Because I tend to be the first of to say, regulatory principle, this is what we really need to do. God's given us, and I give the best hours of my day, and because I give the best hours of the day, I get to set the pace on this. And so this is what we really need to do, and go. And then someone goes, I don't want to do that. I go, you're a rebellious, stiff-necked person. Now I really understand how Moses felt, because you're a big kid. You know what I mean? You know what I mean? And like, and if you don't like, you know, I mean, like, I go through all that. That's not about, even if I'm right about where I want to go and where, as part of the community, I'd like to see us go, it's not really ultimately about that. It's about this process of compassion and putting on love and letting the peace of Christ rule in our midst, and understanding if the word of Christ is going to dwell richly among us, you know, like that means that we have to understand it, conduct ourselves in a way as if Jesus is present, that, you know, we as the church are the living presence of Jesus, and so we have a responsibility to conduct ourselves in a certain way with each other. I wonder if that's ultimately it, because now I'm remembering what I forgot, because this is the thing, and I think this is the key thing as leaders for us to start understanding and really fleshing out, is we're operating in our understanding that Christianity is a philosophical world system, worldview system, and the practices come out of that. And in reality, I think we need to flip it and say, Christianity is a daily life practice of trading the old man for Christ. And like, we don't see Jesus coming in and doing focus group seminars on, this is the, you know, the socioeconomic political fallout of the kingdom of God, and this is my large philosophical program that I'm giving here, and now that I've convinced you of it, now let's go do these things. He comes in action, the word of God, the eternal word that's spoken in the person of Jesus comes in the form of a life, not in the form of, you know, a mounted program via speech, you know. Kingdom of God is not about talk, you know. And so it's like, I think that if we flip that, you know, and I talked about this with my senior pastor, and he just was, you know, he's you know, love the man, learn a lot from him, but he loves your, but he just was like, but don't you need the concepts, don't you need the concepts in the program to know, to inform your action? And I go, no, the action program has already been given to us. We have Christ, and we enter into daily practices in relation to that, and out of that, that will obviously have fallout philosophically, politically, economically, and everything, but we enter into a life practice, daily practice, and I wonder if we flip that, then we probably wouldn't end up having as many discussions sitting on the table about, is it right for us to, you know, sing Star Spangled Banner on 4th of July, you know what I mean, because that's not really, you know, at church, because that's not really the issue. You know, and it's like maybe the issue isn't convincing you to be in a life group. Maybe the issue is what's the best way for you to be able to put on the daily practice of being clothed in compassion and kindness and mercy and love and humility. And, you know, maybe that's the primary issue, you know. I don't know. But that's very counter. It's so intuitive. It's counterintuitive, but, you know, because we start this way and I think we got to.